Secretary General, thank you very much indeed. And now I call on Nick Gowing, our moderator, to take his place in the middle of the room there. And I'd ask our three panelists, please, Francois Iceberg, Laurie Friedman, and Sven Mixer, to come up here onto the podium. Thank you. Good to see you. And Nick, over to you.
Thank you, Jamie. Time is short. That clock has stopped, but don't believe that that means you can have a strategic concept by the end of today. That is the clock that matters. We're already 10 minutes late, so my job is even tougher. This is a new form of flattening structures, with a round table becoming this kind of sausage shape. We almost need binoculars to see you at the other end, so that's why I'm standing here. But the aim is to have a giant conversation among 430 of you. If you work out the arithmetic, that's going to be extremely difficult by 5:30 today. Let me explain what I meant for Jamie when I said, could you just write down if you want to intervene, particularly on this first session, on a bit of paper. Could you do that so I've got an idea of who wants to say what? I will come to you to make personal remarks, but there are runners around, NATO staff, and if you can get those bits of paper to me soonest, then I can at least put it in some kind of order. The aim is to get as many ideas on the record and on the agenda as possible. We won't resolve most of them, but the aim is to make sure that as many of you can say whatever you want to say as a contribution in this first shot on the strategic concept. There is no hierarchy. It's free seating. There's no hierarchy between the front and the back row, except at the back you don't have a microphone, but I'll get a microphone to you, so will all my moderator colleagues. If you work out the mathematics of this, I'm going to invite the three speakers in this session to speak for no more than 6 minutes, and none of you to speak for more than 2 minutes. I will be timing you, and that is what will happen if I think you're going on too long. Just that will be the indication that I think it's time you wrap up. But that's in the interest of getting as many ideas on the record as possible. I'm really here as an enabler, along with all my moderator colleagues. Have sympathy with us in this room. It's mighty difficult to get as many voices from you to be heard as possible. That said, let's get going, and I'll ask Francois. Francois, your first 6 minutes.
Well, thank you, Nick. It is indeed a bit intimidating to be speaking in this vast hall, which makes the UN General Assembly look like a rather intimate, cozy gathering in comparison. The Secretary General used an Irish joke, and I'll begin with my own, which is, if you want to get to where you want to go, I would advise you not to start from here. Now, we all know that that is not an option, but there is maybe some truth in that saying. Et puisque je vais prendre comme base pour ma présentation l'expérience du livre blanc français sur la défense et la sécurité nationale, je vais maintenant parler en français pour tenter de répondre à la question « Do strategic reviews serve a purpose ?» Well, the short answer is yes, and the longer answer is yes, maybe. Et je rentre maintenant dans le détail. Quelques leçons que je retire de l'expérience du livre blanc et de quelques autres expériences du même type. Tout d'abord, le processus compte énormément. Et dans le cadre du livre blanc français, il y avait à peu près 2/3 d'officiels, insiders, 1/3 de non-officiels. Alors, ça, ce n'est pas forcément une garantie de qualité, mais ça apporte quelque chose de très important, c'est d'obliger à regarder les problèmes sous l'ensemble de leurs aspects, c'est-à-dire aussi bien stratégiques et politiques, et pas seulement, et certainement pas principalement, bureaucratiques. C'est ça qui a permis la composition qui a été choisi en France du livre blanc. C'est sans doute plus difficile à utiliser comme formule dans l'élaboration d'un concept stratégique comme celui d'une organisation internationale où le recours à la diplomatie intergouvernementale fait partie du code génétique. Deuxième leçon, ça vaut vraiment la peine de passer beaucoup de temps, peut-être plus de temps que vous ne l'auriez pensé au départ, sur l'analyse du fonctionnement du système international. quand nous avons entamé l'examen du livre blanc en France, et, bon, on a regardé bien sûr le livre blanc d'avant, celui de 1994, qui était un bon livre blanc, qui nous a rendu beaucoup de services. Et quand on l'a regardé, on a dit, mais c'est formidable, il y a tout dedans. Il y a le terrorisme, il y a la prolifération, il y a le monde multipolaire, et ainsi de suite. Mais, en fait, nous avons constaté, lors de l'examen du monde tel qu'il était, que tout le reste avait changé. Le système d'exploitation, le logiciel avait changé. Nous étions passés du monde de l'après-guerre froide à un système modelé par la logique de la mondialisation. Et je pense que c'est ce que l'on constatera, mutatis mutandis, lorsque l'on comparera le concept stratégique de 1999 à la situation dans laquelle se trouve l'OTAN en 2009-2010. Troisième point, l'un des grands points de force du livre blanc en France, c'est l'expression de rupture stratégique, strategic discontinuity, comme l'a rappelé tout à l'heure le secrétaire général. Et un monde plus imprévisible où beaucoup de défis de sécurité ont un potentiel de mondialisation, où les défis tendent à être transfrontières, où les barrières traditionnelles entre les menaces délibérées intentionnelles et les risques non intentionnels cessent d'être tout à fait aussi pertinentes que naguère, où les cloisonnements entre ce qui relève de la politique extérieure et de la politique intérieure, où ces cloisonnements eux-mêmes cessent d'avoir le même sens que naguère. Regardez la lutte contre le terrorisme, regardez la lutte contre les pandémies et la lutte contre les conséquences stratégiques du réchauffement climatique, et ainsi de suite. Si tout cela est vrai, vous allez déboucher a priori sur deux conclusions doctrinales et organisationnelles, c'est ce que nous avons fait. D'une part, vous allez mettre l'accent sur la fonction stratégique qu'est la connaissance et l'anticipation, knowledge-based security, si vous voulez, d'une part, et d'autre part, un concept que nous avons pillé à nos amis britanniques, c'est le concept de résilience, puisque dans le monde, à l'époque de la mondialisation, on ne peut pas prévoir tous les coûts. Il faut donc s'organiser pour limiter la portée des coûts que nous subissons et nous organiser pour rebondir par rapport aux problèmes que nous aurons subis. Alors, dans le cadre national, nous avons, dans le cas de la France, pu mettre en place un certain nombre d'institutions nouvelles, mis en place de nouvelles priorités budgétaires, notamment dans le domaine du renseignement. Tout cela, tout en continuant de devoir faire ce que nous avons fait dans le passé, c'est-à-dire l'importance des interventions militaires, et tout en devant également prendre en compte le retour à la guerre, le retour à la politique de puissance dans un monde multipolaire qui, à certains égards, renvoie davantage au XIXe siècle qu'au XXe siècle. Ça fait donc une palette de défis de sécurité et de défense beaucoup plus large à couvrir que naguère. Pour l'OTAN, et I will do my wrapping up now, it's the moderator. Pour l'OTAN, vous avez un triple défi. Le premier, c'est que par rapport à cette situation de risques et de menaces beaucoup plus larges, l'étroitesse relative de la base de compétences de l'OTAN peut poser problème. Et pour l'OTAN, le vrai défi sera d'organiser l'interface entre sa base de compétences excellente mais étroite et les bases de compétences d'autres organisations internationales ou régionales. Deuxième défi, c'est celui que pose l'articulation entre la composition de l'Alliance Atlantique, composition euro-atlantique, par rapport à des défis qui sont rarement spécifiques à la région euro-atlantique. Ça, c'est un problème que l'OTAN connaît déjà depuis quelques temps, mais que vous allez continuer à rencontrer dans l'élaboration du concept stratégique. Et enfin, et pour conclure, contrairement à un État-nation qui, a priori, sait qui il est, quelle est son identité, pour une organisation comme la vôtre, ben vous allez retrouver les débats familiers, mais exacerbés dans le cadre de l'élaboration du concept stratégique de quel est l'objectif primordial ou les objectifs primordiaux de l'OTAN. Est-ce que c'est la famille américano-européenne? Est-ce que c'est la capacité expéditionnaire en soutien aux initiatives de la communauté internationale? Est-ce que c'est l'article 5? Est-ce que c'est une force pour la réforme dans les nouveaux pays adhérents? Est-ce que c'est la production d'interopérabilité pour pouvoir créer des coalitions de pays capables et volontaires? Merci pour votre attention.
Merci bien, François. Thank you very much indeed. Let me remind you, can you get a slip of paper to me as fast as possible? Just one line and your name will be helpful. Then I can come to you and know where you are and also what you might want to say. Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman, you wrote in The World Today at Chatham House a couple of months ago, one thing international organizations are not good at is strategy unless framed in the most vague, platitudinous and cryptic terms. You have 6 minutes for the prospect for NATO.
I can't imagine I said such a thing.
You wrote it.
Well, actually, I thought, given that somebody's got to question the...
It's all right. Put it closer.
Yeah. Given that somebody's got to question strategic concepts, I thought, and given that I had some suspicion you might quote that, I thought I would start by just raising some issues about whether or not a strategic concept is needed. My view about these things is the same as, I think, a general military view about plans. Plans are useless. Planning is essential. That the process of debate, of argument, of analysis is extremely useful, opens up issues, makes it possible to address new sorts of issues that are coming along. Forcing all of this to a conclusion, however, may well result in something that is compromised, cryptic, hard to appreciate. The nuances and subtleties that the drafters have gone over and over again in order to have a document that can be generally accepted. For me, strategy is about a dynamic interaction with one's environment. It is about purposes of power, the use of power, and it's very hard, I think, in a document which is meant to last, to capture that sense of dynamism. So that we need a strategy for Afghanistan. I'm not sure we need a strategy, a single strategy, for NATO. And I think there's a number of reasons why this may be so. First, this is a defensive alliance. It's not an offensive alliance. If we were planning to conquer the world, then we'd need a strategy. But because we're more likely to be reacting to the challenges posed by others, it's very hard to anticipate in advance where those challenges are likely to come from. And if you think about NATO's strategies in the past, or the similar sort of exercises in the past, the most successful are those which are shortest and simplest. It's been argued when every time an American president tries to enunciate a doctrine, unless you can get it on a T-shirt, it won't work. Well, NATO in the 1960s had flexible response and defense and détente. Very easy to understand, captured basic political truths, and you didn't really need to elaborate beyond that, especially with flexible response. All you needed to know was that there would be a response. As NATO itself had no idea what it would be in those circumstances, all you could say was that it would be flexible. Furthermore, alliance is an objective of strategy. This is what strategists try to achieve. They try to achieve alliances. When Churchill realized that the United States was now an ally of Britain, he went to bed content and said, "I knew we had won. I knew there would be terrible things to happen, but we would win because the combination was going to be unbeatable." The great thing about NATO is it has already solved the basic problem of strategy. It has got a winning, superior coalition. And it's not surprising, therefore, that there's going to be some difficulty in working out what you do with that, because the basic advantage of such a large accumulation of power is that it acts as a deterrent in itself. There will no doubt be long and complicated and arduous debates, which I have been party to throughout my career, about how we actually word nuclear deterrence in such a thing. But the point is that whatever we say about the circumstances in which we would use nuclear weapons, and it's bound to be vague and convoluted, and people will worry about chemical and biological weapons and so on. In current circumstances, frankly, I think NATO should be rather minimise the importance of nuclear weapons. But the fact is there will still be a deterrent effect, because nobody can be sure what would happen in the very circumstances in which it might possibly be considered. Therefore, agonising about the question is not necessarily going to produce an answer. And the effect, the deterrent effect you want, is in the mere existence of the weapons themselves. You don't really have to elaborate too far. And in current circumstances, with all the pressure for disarmament and reductions, I would not want the alliance to go on about the values of nuclear weapons. Finally, I think it's worth just reminding ourselves how difficult it is to get these things right. A decade ago, we were in the middle of debates about humanitarian intervention, and the question of the conditions and circumstances and principles under which they would continue. And we were talking about the revolution in military affairs. Remember the revolution in military affairs? It was the big thing of the 1990s. And if it was really a revolution in military affairs, it would still be dominating everything we do 10 years on. But how often do you hear that mentioned now? We've moved on to transformation, and no doubt with a new administration, we'll move on to something else. And it turned out the revolution was not a revolution in the way people were anticipating, in some of the ways, because it didn't take account of the political context in which this new military technology would be implemented and new military organizations formed. The political context is the critical thing. And it's the political context that, if you're thinking about strategy, you need to get right. Let me just conclude with two observations about the difficulty in our current situation. And I put these out as issues for discussion. The first is our uncertainty about democracy and popular movements. It seems to me that our natural instinct from the countries that we come from democracies, is to want it, to approve of it. We now realize it's difficult to impose. It must be desired and sought. But even when it's desired and sought, as we've seen recently in Iran, that has the effect of changing the strategic context. And so we find at the moment that the sort of realpolitik moves that many of us thought to be sensible in dealing with the Iranian government seem somehow inappropriate when you're dealing with one that's in the process of denying the result of an election. What we've seen is that the color revolutions have been understood better by authoritarian regimes, possibly, than by us. And the implications of that is one thing that I think is going to be important over the coming months, never mind years. The second is counterinsurgency. We have a view about counterinsurgency that moves quickly towards hearts and minds. And I think that's appropriate, especially when we're likely to be engaged in countries other than our own. But countries that believe that they're dealing with counterinsurgency as an immediate direct security problem to them don't take it so neatly. We've had this year Gaza, Sri Lanka, and SWAT. None of these are classic NATO counterinsurgency campaigns. They all may claim some success. And I think one of the other difficult issues that we're going to have to address is the relationship between our strategic principles, democratic principles, and the exercise of power outside of Europe in places that matter to us, where it is not necessarily going to be seen with the same sort of values and concerns as we have. And it comes back to this point about alliance. The key thing for NATO is that it is an alliance, and that's its greatest benefit. The second important thing is it has to work with others. And we have to realise when we're working with others that they may not want to work quite the way that we want them to work. Thank you.
Lawrence Friedman, thank you. Let's move on with Sven Mikser. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Even though I don't have that much to say, I try to keep it brief. I'm representing the NATO Parliamentary Assembly here, and I've just recently taken over from Jan Petersen from Norway, who was coordinating the deliberations of the Parliamentary Assembly of NATO on the new strategic concept. And we at the national parliamentarians in different NATO countries, obviously we are among the qualified experts and eminent persons. We are the Omaha milkmen, or at least we need to get their votes in order to be re-elected. So we are critically interested in the new strategic being readable and understandable for our publics. Also, I think the NATO PA deliberations on the new strategic concept are useful because the member delegations of the Parliamentary Assembly, unlike the national governments, obviously they represent, especially in case of large countries, the full political spectrum, and so they represent more diverse views and perhaps sometimes less mainstream views than the national governments who are debating around the table at the North Atlantic Council. Also, since we do not operate on the consensus principle, sometimes the assembly deliberations provide some sort of sense as to where the majority opinion within the alliance is moving. In our discussions, we have come to a conclusion that we do need a new strategic concept, and for two very obvious reasons, which have been repeated many times already. First, because the previous or the existing strategic concept was a consensus or shared position of 16, and today we have 8 allies, but also because there are many new security challenges around. And our deliberations have been concentrating on 4 sets of issues. First, roles and missions. And here, obviously, it is a key challenge to find a right balance between the nuclear and conventional forces needed for deterrence and defense, but also between the forces needed for sort of core functions of Article 5, or traditional territorial defense, and the set of forces needed for operations outside the alliance territory. And obviously, the security today is indivisible, and we need to go outside our national territory sometimes to protect and defend our populations. But we need to acknowledge that sometimes the sets of forces and the capabilities we required for these missions are somewhat different from those that are required for traditional challenges or addressing the traditional challenges. And then obviously, we have to acknowledge that there are new security threats such as cybersecurity, on defense against cyber attacks, energy security, securing energy supplies, piracy, terrorism, and so on and so forth. We need to acknowledge that these new security challenges do not replace the existing ones. They do not come in the stead of the existing security challenges. They come in addition to the existing security challenges. Sometimes perhaps we get too carried away trying to solely concentrate on the newest of the security challenges or threats. Second set of issues is disarmament and arms control. And obviously, we parliamentarians are very peace-loving people, And we greet with huge enthusiasm the ideas of reduction or possible elimination of nuclear weapons. Here, again, we have to take into account how this would, if ever achieved, affect the overall balance of powers. We must take into account that the conventional, or we are conventionally far superior compared to our challenges, and the elimination of nuclear deterrent might require some sort of trade-off or some sort of bargain to address that issue. then the relations with Russia obviously is a topic that is very very much debated also among the parliamentarians. And here the views do diverge quite significantly. What I would like to say is that we need also to pursue a change of tone from our partner, from Russia. It is quite remarkable that a partner of such importance continues to refer to the alliance as its main strategic adversary. I think it is of key importance to change that. Then partnerships obviously are increasingly more important, both our immediate neighbors who for some reason do not qualify or have not chosen to join the alliance, but also strategic partners outside the North Atlantic geographical region. And to conclude, I would like to say that the process obviously is extremely important. It is a good idea to engage a team of qualified experts or eminent persons. At the same time, it is critically important that all NATO nations, big and small, new and old, get the sense of ownership of the new strategic concept. And therefore, the engagement of all the national governments and all the national parliaments and publics, as much as they can be engaged, or as much as they can get interested in the subject, be engaged in the process. Thank you very much.
So, and thank you very much. Okay, you can all see the time. We're doing pretty well. Thank you very much for keeping to the time. It's much appreciated as we are under that acute time pressure. Thomas Vlasek, Daniel Korski, and Ian Davis, could you get a microphone, please? I'm going to group a number of questions on just questioning the whole business of the strategic concept. But can I just check in the room, is there anyone, a voice out there, who believes there should be no new strategic concept? Then at least we can narrow down what we're talking about. Are there those who vehemently believe there should not be a new strategic concept? We have consensus. That's good. Right, Thomas Vlasek. Please, a microphone for Thomas Vlasek. Quickly, let's move the microphones around very quickly. Or use one of these microphones at the front. Can you get the microphone here, please? And then a microphone to Daniel Korski, please. Could you put up... Where are you, Daniel? You've got a microphone anyway. Please.
Thanks, Nick.
And it's going to be beat the bell, I'm afraid, because I must be brutal. So you've got maximum of 2 minutes.
Shall try to stay on time. Tomas Vlasek, Slovak national, living in London, currently working for the Center for European Reform, a think tank. I wanted to sound a note of caution, possibly. And I wonder if we don't expect a bit too much from a strategic concept, from the exercise of writing the strategic concept in one important sense. I think the Secretary General was absolutely right to say that we have a problem with low public support for NATO and for defense in general. If we think we have trouble finding the support, the financial support for operations now, well, things are only going to get worse with the economic crisis, as the Secretary General reminded us rightly a few minutes ago. So I think we're right to want to look for ways to drum up more public support for NATO in particular and for defense spending and for our operations in general. But I wonder if, to paraphrase François Heisberg, paraphrasing somebody else, if the exercise of writing the strategic concept would be the place where I start from. In this excellent paper that you have in your packs, Karl-Heinz Kamp wrote, "Many governments take the lack of interest of their electorates in defense issues for granted and refrain from any attempt to counter this trend." And it seems to me governments is where I would start rather than the process of writing the strategic concept. At the end of the day, the reminder of Truman's quote, "The strategic concept has to be understandable to the milkman in Omaha," is absolutely right. It has to be lucid. It has to be clear. But governments will have to take it and make the case to their electorate that this document is important, that it matters, that NATO matters, that defense spending matters. And I wonder, again, if we put a little too much emphasis on the exercise of writing the strategic concept and if we're letting the governments off the hook. I have a question, Nick, which is to both François and Sir Leir Friedman, because you both have, both your countries, France and Britain, have recently gone through an exercise of, in Britain's case, writing a new national security strategy, in France's case, writing the new white paper. Have the exercises of writing these new important strategic documents have any effect on drumming up more public interest and more public support in defense and in military spending?
Thanks, Thomas. Can you stack those questions towards the end, please? Let's go to Daniel Korski, followed by Ian Davis. Can you make sure, Ian Davis, that you've got a microphone?
Hi, I'm Daniel Korski from the think tank, the European Council on Foreign Relations. Picking up on something Thomas said, I mean, it strikes me that most populations in our countries think NATO is an old war, Cold War relic, and if anything, engages us in unwinnable wars at the behest of one or two allies. And yet at the same time, we all agree that we need to use the strategic concept to sort of sell ourselves again. But how do we do that, especially to those who are under 35 and women who poll after poll say that they don't care for NATO? So I wonder how we actually take this incredibly complex and elite process and turn it into something, if you will, palatable and edible to this broader voter base.
You have a minute. Do you have a solution you want to offer, Daniel?
Well, I would say that we have to be much broader than what we are today. 400 of us ambassadors, generals, and so forth are only going to take us some way. I think the importance is to broaden it out far greater than we have, use new media. I think we need to have a parallel process with, you know, under 35s. I think we have to talk about security. What do people care about? And not what do you care about that NATO's going to do for you, but what do you care about for security in your life, and see what kind of debate that generates. So much broader, using new media and addressing far younger audiences.
Right, thank you. Ian Davis, followed by Harlan Ullman, please. Where are you, Ian? Please.
Over here. Yes, I just follow on.
Just introduce yourself, can you?
Yeah, Ian Davis from ISIS Europe and NATO Watch, so from non-governmental sector. And it's really following on from the two previous comments, really. How do you engage the 890 million citizens in the consultation process when there are no mechanisms for the Milkman and Omaha to take place in this process? And NATO remains the only major intergovernmental organization without an information disclosure policy, for example. Now, I think it's not rocket science to produce mechanisms to enable citizens to participate in this sort of process. If we're going down the route of an eminent persons group, a consultation draft could be the first outcome, and that could be open via websites to enable public participation, public comment. There could be processes through national areas, through parliamentary committees that can review early drafts, even parliamentary discussion. This is a one-off opportunity really to have a fundamental rethink about security and really reaching out and engaging with public citizens. So I'll be interested to know what the panel think about opportunities for engaging citizens.
Remember, we're putting a lot on the agenda here. Much of it will not be answered in this session. There are other sessions to follow on that. Harlan Ullman.
I'm Harlan Ullman. I have an observation that I want to put in the form of a stark parliamentary question to everybody here, including the panelists. And that is, very simply, is NATO relevant or is it a relic? And I think that becomes the most profound issue with which we have to wrestle. I think all of us here believe that NATO is indeed very relevant, but I haven't heard any compelling statements in a sentence or two to make that case. And so I hope throughout the day we will do that. And I'd like to put this in the further context of Afghanistan. In my judgment, we collectively are losing in Afghanistan. And the reason that we are losing is because despite the lip service and the laudatory praise we may heap on a comprehensive approach, we have been derelict in dealing with the civil side. So we can win every battle, and as we have determined in other conflicts, lose the war. So I return to my question, and the publics who want to know, is NATO relevant or is it a relic? And if it is relevant, could somebody please express that in a few sentences?
Do you want to propose a sentence, Helen? Okay. Put
Laurie
two,
Friedman,
two
Laurie,
sentences on the record.
Flexible response. Flexible response was brilliant in the 60s because it was a political way of mitigating the huge gap on both sides of the Atlantic between conventional and nuclear deterrence. What we have to do is provide for the members of the alliance a way of choosing which threats, which dangers, which issues of security are most important, and provide the flexibility so the alliance can have an opportunity to deal with the threats that each member thinks is most important without destroying the integrity and cohesion of the alliance.
Thank you. Henning Rieke, please, next. I don't know where you are. What I'm trying to do is create a thread here, building on comments. So if you urgently want to come in on a particular thing which has just been said about a particular issue, please, if necessary, just put up your hand and shout if necessary so I can hear you from the back of my head.
Okay. Henning Rieke, German Council on Foreign Relations. I think in the process of negotiating the strategic concept, NATO will face this challenging situation that the strategic deliberations will be overtaken by events in the case of Afghanistan. So the experience of talking about out of area in 1999 and preparing for the Kosovo war might be copied in the next 2 years here. So I think one of the very important functions of the process on talking about the strategic concept is to define very soberly, very pragmatically, what is success in Afghanistan. This has several functions. It will first create the cohesion among the allies that is only growing now what is to be done in Afghanistan. It will also provide at one point in time for legitimacy of exiting Afghanistan, but it will also help us to focus a little bit more on the success of what we want to do in Afghanistan and not on the slightly desperate talk on how can we retreat from Afghanistan. And with this success, we might have a better opportunity to win over the publics of the NATO member states. As a notion of what success should be, I think it should be pretty clear that there must be more than the phrase that the Afghans can take care of their security on their own. There must be a clear notion that maybe some areas of Afghanistan are not as safe as others. There must be a clear notion that there must be an international presence able to infringe on things like drugs, on a civil society, that the creation of a civil society, that there must be a clear focus on stopping Taliban networks to operate from Afghanistan, and there must be a clear notion what NATO's role should be in working with Pakistan in this sense. So this should be an element that I would include early on in the process of the strategic concept.
Thanks very much indeed. Ambassador Vandala.
Belgian ambassador to NATO, I welcome you all to the great halls of the Belgian Foreign Ministry. Si nous voulons aboutir à un concept stratégique qui convainque les opinions publiques, je pense qu'il faudra absolument dépasser une série de nos contradictions internes et je me suis amusé à en noter déjà 4 et en sans doute plus. On dit qu'il faut adapter nos moyens à notre mission. Je me dois de faire remarquer qu'en Europe, du moins, dans un avenir prévisible, les dépenses militaires n'augmenteront pas. Donc dire qu'il faut adapter nos moyens à notre mission, je crois, devant nos opinions publiques, ne sera pas convaincant. Deux, nous interprétons l'article 5, je l'ai entendu ce matin, de façon extensive et en même temps nous disons que la solidarité n'est pas un bon argument. Article 5 étant basé sur la solidarité. C'est une contradiction interne et il faut faire attention de ne pas trop réduire l'argument de la solidarité. Je crois que dans l'opinion publique de mon pays, ça joue un rôle important et je crois qu'il ne faut pas le marginaliser. Troisième contradiction interne. On dit que security at home is not different from security abroad. C'est sans doute vrai, mais je crois que cela ne peut pas obscurcir, oblitérer la distinction fondamentale qui doit rester entre ce qui menace notre souveraineté et notre intégrité territoriale d'une part, et ceux qui sont des menaces de sécurité. La distinction est importante puisqu'elle conduit donner des indications sur avec qui on travaille. Donc c'est une distinction à maintenir. Quatrième et dernier point. Oui, évidemment, à l'approche globale, mais alors nous devrions pouvoir prouver que nous sommes effectivement capables d'établir des synergies efficaces avec des parties tierces, notamment avec l'Union européenne. Et donc, Monsieur le modérateur, je souhaite beaucoup de succès aux experts qualifiés.
Thank you very much indeed. Stephen Flanagan, then followed by Eugenia Smolar. Where are you, Stephen?
No, I had...
Where are you?
Right here.
I'm sorry, I beg your pardon.
No, Stephen Flanagan from CSIS in Washington. François Heisberg noted the strategic discontinuity or unpredictability of the emerging global strategic environment, which, by the way, was even noted in passing in paragraph 4 of the 1999 strategic concept. But that drives us, of course, as he noted, towards the kind of resilience what the military might refer to more as capabilities-based planning for future challenges. That seems to me makes our challenge even harder in how do you articulate that kind of resilience to the broader public when you're talking about a very broad range of capabilities and contingencies we might need to address. And I wonder if the panel might like to kick that around a bit as to how do you put this on the bumper sticker, how do you reach Generation Next, as Daniel had mentioned, with this kind of general array of challenges that we need to be prepared for.
Certainly, there are a lot of you who do want to raise this issue of projecting this process into the public domain. Eugenius.
Eugenius Smola, Center for International Relations, Warsaw. No doubt the process would be full only if the political leaders and political parties, which are pro-NATO, which are transatlantic-oriented, would take this issue back home and sort of continue the process of debating those issues in the countries concerned. Otherwise, the milkman in Warsaw would not understand it more than the milkman outside of Nice. Second, what kind of a document we want? Already I've heard sort of two kind of arguments. One argument is for the very short and diplomatic and the general document because the process is more meaningful than the document itself. I couldn't disagree with that more. The whole process has to end with a comprehensive document which will respond to a comprehensive security problems. Otherwise, it will be just rolling over the problem, postponing it, or giving it a chance to any kind of interpretations for the member states and its partners around the world. Thank you.
Thank you. Admiral Trevino.
Thank you very much. I'm Admiral Trevino, Spanish MILREP to NATO and European Union. My main work is providing advice, military advice, inside the military committee. So may I suggest to give some military ideas to all these very interesting civilian conclusions.
Could you just pull the microphone down a little bit?
Yes.
Thank you.
In his introductory remarks, the SecGen gave a lot of good ideas, but for me the best was speaking about the threat. We cannot write any plan without knowing the threat. What is the threat to NATO and also the nations inside NATO? And we have the solution to the answer of how valid is the 1999 concept. We have a very good Bible, intelligence Bible, called MC-161. So we only need to compare the MC-161 99 edition and study how was the threat in that year, that's mean 10 years ago, and compare to the MC-161 2009 edition and see how this threat has been changed. In order to change, we need to rewrite a new strategic concept and see the difference with the previous strategic concept. Thank you very much.
Espen Eide.
Thank you, Espen Barth Eide, Deputy Minister of Defence of Norway. Let me first associate myself fully with Thomas and Daniel and others who have been talking about the inclusiveness of the process. This process is only going to be successful if we are inclusive when it comes to member state governments and also inclusive when it comes to population and publics and the media, precisely because the process is probably as important as the outcome. What I wanted to comment upon is and agree with the Secretary General in his opening statement that there is no option to choose between either home or away. Both of them constitute each other, and NATO can only do both. It's not possible for NATO to either or. On the other hand, they are not the same. And I think the reason that some of us have been raising the issue about the balance between deployed operations and Article 5 responsibilities is that we have to be aware of the danger that the urgency of deployed operations and the absolute necessary to focus on deployed operations may come at the expense of our capability to plan for a tomorrow, which is different than the continuation of today. And with the return of geopolitics to parts of Europe and the new power structures in the world, the need for a Western value-based transatlantic community of security and interest is as important as ever, but it really needs to address some of the issues that we from the Norwegian side have been raising in the core area initiative. Prudent planning, also for the home mission, intelligence sharing, geographical responsibility at NATO commands, more exercises, and also a reconsideration of the direction of transformation, not whether to transform, but which is the direction of transformation. And just to underline the main point, it is only if we are credible at home that we will be able to convince publics in the long run to send troops to faraway places. If we don't, that will eventually evaporate, and that will be a very detrimental situation to the alliance.
Thank you. Nuno Ruggiero and then Tina Flockhart.
Yeah. Nuno Ruggiero from Portugal, Euro-Atlantic Institute and SIG-TV News. Talking about the milkman, I think we should worry about things we can change, but not about things we cannot change. And I think that one thing is for the milkman to understand. Another thing is for the milkman to find the things we are saying here relevant. These are two totally different things. I think we should invest in explaining, but we should not hope too much that things become immediately relevant for the milkman. On the question of review, I think that there are lots of us here that are saying virtually in the closet that there is not a need for a new strategic concept, but for an updated one. These are different things. I think we don't need a new one. What we need is an update. Certain things were not present in 99, but most of the things were present already in concept in 99. Even the issue of terrorism was present as a concept in 99. Human security was present as a question in 99. So my big question for the speakers is, what exactly were the traits that were not present, either in the threat environment or in the structure of NATO? Because I don't see also that the structure of NATO has changed so much, so we need a new concept. For instance, the values are the same. The principles are the same. We grew in numbers, but we didn't change the principles.
Thank you, Nuno. Tina, and then Julian Lindley-Francis.
Okay. My name is Trine Flockhart. I'm from the Danish Institute for International Studies. I have been wondering whether we're, in effect, putting the cart before the horse, because the discussion that hasn't really taken place in NATO is the discussion that has taken place in the EU for years and years and years, and this is, what is the finality of NATO? I think before you can start discussing what is the strategic concept and what are the threats that we need to deal with, there needs to be a much clearer vision for what is it NATO is for. Now, that was always very clear during the Cold War, where NATO was a defense alliance, and we still refer to NATO as a defense alliance. But I think the time of NATO as a defense alliance has passed, and it is now time to really start to discuss what is NATO for, what is our vision for the future for NATO, before we can actually put a strategic concept into place. Thank you.
Thank you. Julian Lindley-Francis, the public's wait to be well led.
Yeah, thank you. Julian Lindley-French. I'm going to throw a voice of caution about the public education theme that we've had thus far. As Nick said, publics want to be well led.
I'm quoting you here.
I know you are, and I'm expanding on it, Nick. Thank you. The problem, as such as it is the disconnect between the political class, an increasingly ill-informed political class, and security practitioners. Now, it strikes me that the strategic concept as a process must A, re-establish a contract between the political leadership and those of you who carry it out on behalf of publics, and state very clearly what is the contract at the very heart of alliance between the members and partners in the world as it is. In the debate I've heard thus far, it's very incremental. It's very much about building on what we've done in the past better. My concern listening to this, now publics sense it, the pace of change happening beyond our borders seems far faster and far more profound than our ability to cope with it. Now that's the message that we need to get across, not to explain in copious measures to our publics, who by and large are not engaged fully on this, what we are going to do, but to reassure them, A, we have gripped the world as it is, and B, we are up to the job of organising ourselves to best effect. If the concept can do this, it's adding value. If not, I fear another 1999 bureaucratic morass.
Thank you. Michael Williams, then Giovanni Gasparini.
Julian stole my thunder. Michael Williams from the University of London and the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington. First, I completely agree with Daniel and the others who said you need to reach out to younger populations. I teach kids who were born between 1987 and 1989. They have no relevance, no interest, no understanding of NATO. They think it should close up shop. I think we should be very skeptical, as Julian noted, though, the idea to have a public consultation and what sort of feedback you're actually going to get. Part of the beauty of living in London is I hang out with bankers and dancers and reinsurers and artists who, quite frankly, don't care. And so I think sort of when you have a public consultation, a wider one in terms of the experts you need, the age range you need, but I would be skeptical of people who read The Guardian offering you lots of useful information. So what I would suggest to do, and I think Julian's right, is to focus on your core tasks. And Harlan was talking about what's NATO good for and expanding the alliance. I think you cannot be everything to everyone. And I think that the new strategic concept, you could use it to codify what we've done. This is the last 20 years of meandering. Or you can use it as a breakthrough. You could actually have an honest, good planning session, lots of debate, and distill a basic premise, right? Simple statements, accessible to the public, a new contract, right? And acknowledge that we can only do certain things, that there's a wider community out there. The perception from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America is very different than how we perceive ourselves in this room. The idea that we will self-legitimate every action through the alliance in South Asia, in Africa, etc. Very difficult. Just had discussions with the Japanese. We don't know how to engage NATO. We don't know how to engage the Western world when you continually self-legitimate yourselves. Core premises, don't show off more than we can chew. Define ourselves. Say this is what we do well. We coordinate. We can plan. We can implement. We can provide the front end of security. But we need the UN. We need the EU. We need the wider world to work with us. And that, I think, you can sell your, if you can define yourselves well, then the public will accept your relevance. But continually arguing and trying to justify your relevance will only dig you into a deeper hole.
Giovanni Gasparini, please. And then Tommy Steiner.
Yes, Giovanni Gasparini from the International Affairs Institute based in Rome. On the PR problem concerning the strategic concept, the problem here is that we have to have something to communicate because we actually communicate it. So I would like to go back a bit to the basic of marketing, if you wish, which are the four Ps. The first one being that the promotion is at the end. You have to have the product before actually promote it. And what I think we are lacking here is exactly the product, in the sense that first of all, we need to have a shared vision of the security future, which is, I think, this is something, an exercise that is still lacking, and this is the fundament of our analysis, I think. The second element is positioning the alliance, and that's the second P, using the concept of comparative advantages into these security scenarios. So which are in the foreseeable security scenarios, which are the one that we are trying to address, and the only way of choosing them is choosing the one in which the alliance is better tailored to address. And the third element, this also excludes a bit the approach that has been taken so far, which is a list approach of all the possible potential security elements without coordinating them, without prioritizing them, and so on, which I call fishing for troubles. We find that there is something hot on the spot, and we go for that. I think this approach needs to end because it's detrimental, actually, to the coherence of the alliance. The last part, therefore, of the P is the price. We need to be able to communicate which is the price of not getting the strategic concept right. Thank you.
Thank you. Tommy Steiner, please.
I'm over here. Thank you very much. There's been a lot of talk...
You're from the Atlantic Forum of Israel.
That is correct. There's been a lot of talk about the internal importance and relevance of this process and the document. Reaching out, new generations, being inclusive, all this is very important. But I would like to humbly note that this process and the document that will come out of it is also a declaratory statement, a declaratory policy and process aimed at others, aimed at partners, peers, and God forbid we mention it, adversaries. And as such, perceptions of this process will matter. And it's not necessarily...
prioritizing them and so on, which I call fishing for troubles. We find that there is something hot on the spot, and we go for that. I think this approach needs to end because it's detrimental, actually, to the coherence of the alliance. The last part, therefore, of the P is the price. We need to be able to communicate which is the price of not getting the strategic concept right. Thank you.
Thank you. Tommy Steiner, please.
I'm over here. Thank you very much. There's been a lot of talk...
You're from the Atlantic Forum of Israel.
That is correct. There's been a lot of talk about the internal importance and relevance of this process and the document. Reaching out, new generations, being inclusive, all this is very important. But I would like to humbly note that this process and the document that will come out of it is also a declaratory statement, a declaratory policy and process aimed at others, aimed at partners, peers, and God forbid we mention it, adversaries. And as such, perceptions of this process will matter. And it's not necessarily the internal perceptions of Europe. And this will determine the alliance's capability to carry out on this. So the question I would pose to François Hisbourg is, how did the French process on the white paper bolster or support France's international standing and strategic standing? Thank you.
I should tell you that quite a lot of questions are very specific and I think are going to be addressed later on in the day, so I'm putting them to one side for the moment. But Yon Pascu from the European Parliament, again on this issue of the relationship to the... Anne, I'll come to you in a moment. You're at the back, please.
Yes.
Anyone else burning to come in on this issue of the relationship with the public, particularly the next generation, as several of you have raised? Please.
Well, thank you very much. I think you know that we are now at the start of the process and of the exercise, and I think that there are two requirements which you have to fulfill. First is, what has changed so much that to warrant the initiation of the work on a new strategic concept? The second one would be, what do we want to achieve by starting to work at this new strategic concept? And one final thing, if we define success in Afghanistan with what has been left behind after NATO has got out, then I'm wondering what kind of a state do we need there to be more successful than the NATO current forces combating Taliban, and especially after NATO would be out. Thank you.
Anne Dighton, did you want a word?
Yes, very quickly.
Could you just introduce yourself?
Anne Dighton, University of Oxford. We heard two realist accounts from Laurie Friedman and François Hisbourg setting NATO in the context of states. We heard from the Secretary General and from the Danish intervention a more liberal approach, looking at the role, perhaps, of international institutions and, indeed, multilateralism, which I don't think has been mentioned yet. I'd just like to remind people that NATO was created in part from a failure to create a United Nations at the beginning of the Cold War, and that maybe one way of looking ahead is to see NATO as part of a section of international institutions rather than the servant of certain Western states. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to take the next two minutes just to raise the issue of the European Union and relations, because three of you have raised that. Can you just give us a taster? First, Ambassador Robert Hunter. And then also Fabrice Potier and also the Turkish ambassador afterwards.
Devil's advocate. We could get the best strategic concept in the world here, and it's only half the issue, or maybe less than half. Secretary General talked about working with other institutions. Right now in Afghanistan, NATO is blocked from dealing with the EU. The EU really doesn't seem to care very much about the things we do. I would say if we started with the transatlantic relationship and said, what do we have to do, and then figured out which institution would do it, institutions, NATO would do part, EU would do part, but the European Union is not stepping up to the mark. The relationships really don't exist very much. And if we're going to succeed, this has to get the comprehensive approach comprehensively done across institutions. And the question is, what can we do to get the EU to help us break down those barriers that right now are stifling success in Afghanistan and likely elsewhere?
Fabrice Potier.
Yes, thank you. I first owe an apology to the Secretary General. I was complaining to my neighbor that there was not enough European Union in the speech when you came to it. So, but I think we still need to go further in the NATO-EU relationship and think of a new compact. Indeed, both organizations fight to be relevant and effective, so both organizations need each other. So my question is, how can we feed the EU in the strategic concept process? Can't we give the EU a special role in this process to try to put more Europe in this strategic concept? And I think there are two huge opportunities to frame the concept in that sense. First is the strategic concept in itself, because it's a process of engagement and of opening the debate. And second, it's the economic crisis, which is too good to waste, in the sense that you need more joint partnership, you need more shared capabilities in order to do economy of scale. So my question is, how can we put more EU in this NATO strategic concept? Thanks.
You're all raising a lot of questions which won't be answered in this session, but they will roll forward to later. Finally, the Turkish ambassador, before I go to the panel.
Thank you. I fully agree that comprehensive approach will be the key in dealing with the challenges of the security environment. And we very much support that international organizations should better cooperate with each other. And I must particularly refer to the relationship between NATO and the EU. But in that sense, I very much share the disappointment of the Secretary General when he said that in his tenure he couldn't see this relationship to be elevated to strategic partnership. In doing so, I think we have to be realistic. We can't just find a strategic concept of NATO to be the only way to create such a better understanding. I must recall all of us that, as Secretary General has referred to, the EU has recently adopted its updated the security strategy. And I can hardly see any reference to such cooperation or any reference to NATO at all. I mean, therefore, we need to create a common denominator. It is true that there are political problems. Nevertheless, perceptions are also important, and how other organizations perceive NATO is important, and we need to create a better understanding about NATO in those organizations. They shouldn't just see NATO to be a toolbox whenever they need hard security to apply without proper consultation. Thank you.
Ambassador, thank you. Let me ask you to pick up whichever points you choose. You may want to avoid one or two, but if you could give us brief, snappy responses to those you think which have been raised from the floor, which really do take the argument forward. Francois. Microphone. There you are.
Okay. Very quickly. First, the questions raised by Thomas Valasek and our friend from Israel. Why does one do a strategic review? First, public support. In the French case, this was not a big issue, except on one particular item, which was reintegration into NATO. In that respect, I would add the process of producing the white paper was enormously helpful in making sure that all of this will happen without major problems of public support. Secondly, you do it because you need to change your doctrine, your organization, and your budget priorities. This, I think, was the most important part of our own exercise, and this is the area in which things are happening. And the third one is indeed, as was very rightly recalled, credibility vis-à-vis one's partners and vis-à-vis one's adversaries. You will have noted a very strong element of congruence between the strategic direction which exists in the French White Paper. For the first time, we indicated what we considered to be our basic area of strategic interest, essentially from the Western approaches down to the Indian Ocean by way of the Mediterranean, the Red Sea, and the Persian Gulf. What did you see happen? You saw us open a base in the United Arab Emirates. We have finally broken clear 50 years later from the military geography of colonialism. It used to be bases in Africa, and it used to be the rest was France and Europe. Now we put bases where we need them, and we put assets where they're needed, rather than where history told us to put them in the past. Second, relevance and irrelevance. Is this truly the most profound issue? I quote what was asked by one of the questioners. When an organization feels that it needs to ask what its relevance is, you know that organization is in trouble. And if it tries to answer that question, put in those terms, it will start doing the wrong things for the wrong reasons. NATO should take a very different approach, and that is ask itself, qu'est-ce que nous savons faire bien? Quels sont nos cœurs de compétences? Quels sont nos savoir-faire? Et comment pouvons-nous les adapter aux besoins créés par le nouveau contexte de sécurité, bien sûr, mais aussi institutionnel et organisationnel, international. C'est comme ça qu'il faut procéder. Il ne faut pas se poser la question de savoir comment est-ce que nous allons démontrer notre relevance, notre pertinence. Et une organisation comme l'OTAN n'existe pas pour démontrer sa pertinence. Si c'est vraiment ça le cœur du problème, à ce moment-là, il faut effectivement mieux fermer la porte et jeter la clé. Mais je pense qu'il y a d'autres questions plus importantes que le fait de savoir comment démontrer sa pertinence. Troisième point, la question de notre ami portugais. La liste des menaces et des risques n'a pratiquement pas bougé depuis 10 ou même 20 ans. Même les cyberattaques. Quand est-ce que Hollywood a fait son premier film sur les cyberattaques? War Games. Remember War Games? En 1984 ou 83, avec des hackers, des lycéens qui entrent dans le système informatique du Pentagone. C'était il y a 25 ans. Ah, what else is new? Au niveau des problèmes, la liste des problèmes, elle, n'a pas beaucoup bougé depuis l'élimination d'un grand problème qui était l'existence de l'Empire soviétique. Par contre, c'est l'interaction entre tous ces problèmes, entre les menaces et les risques, c'est cette interaction-là qui a profondément changé au cours des 10 dernières années, même pas les 20 dernières années, les 10 dernières années. Et c'était ça un petit peu la découverte que nous avons faite pendant la rédaction du Livre blanc. Beaucoup d'entre nous pensions que, au niveau de la description des risques et des menaces, bon, on allait faire un update de 1994. Mais en fait, on s'est aperçu très vite que nous allions devoir passer beaucoup plus de temps sur le sujet que nous le pensions, parce que la règle du jeu, the rules of the game, ont profondément changé. Enfin, une remarque par rapport à l'observation faite par notre ami militaire italien. Oui, bien sûr, pour pouvoir faire des plans, il faut partir d'une analyse de menaces réelles ou de risques réels. Mais là, je soulignerai trois fois ce qu'a dit Laurie Friedman au début de sa propre intervention, qui est une forme de boutade. Plans are useless, planning is absolutely essential. Bien sûr, nous ne pouvons pas savoir exactement comment se passera la prochaine attaque terroriste. Nous ne pouvons pas savoir comment se produiront les prochains épisodes de prolifération nucléaire. Nous ne pouvons pas savoir où se trouvera le prochain failed state, et ainsi de suite. Mais cela ne doit pas nous empêcher, au contraire, de nous organiser pour précisément faire face à ce niveau plus élevé d'imprévisibilité que naguère, en mettant l'accent sur le early warning, sur l'alerte avancée des problèmes qui peuvent se poser, et de nous organiser pour faire face à des scénarios de menaces ou de risques génériques. Est-ce que ça peut se traduire sous forme de bumper stickers? Ben, all hazards approach. Dans l'approche tout risque en ce qui concerne la sécurité intérieure. C'est ce qu'ont fait les Britanniques. Ils ont eu bien raison. Et là où ça n'a pas existé, comme lors de Katrina à la Nouvelle-Orléans, ben les gens n'ont pas beaucoup apprécié l'absence de la réalité de cette approche. Est-ce qu'en termes internationaux, une approche compréhensive peut s'énoncer sous forme de bumper sticker? Oui. Responsibility to protect, R2P, par exemple. Alors, je ne sais pas si l'OTAN a la capacité ou la volonté d'arriver à cristalliser des concepts simples et compréhensibles, mais d'autres exemples montrent que c'est faisable.
Thank you, François. Sir Lawrence.
Thank you. I agree very much with what François has just said. Let me just add some other points on this craving for public attention and to reaching out to young people. Please don't. It's a bit like my daughter feels when she thinks I'm about to dance. That it becomes embarrassing because an organisation like this is not going to sell well on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter or whatever, and it's not its job. If you really want to get public attention, have an almighty row. That's the best way to have one. You've got all the public attention you wanted in 2002-03 because the alliance was in fundamental disagreement. And if you want attention, please, that's the way to do it. Otherwise, we should be like central bankers. We should be pleased if the organisation is considered boring and uninteresting, because that probably means it's doing its job well. The more you feel you need to address the public and worry about the public, it probably means that you're in trouble. And I agree entirely. We don't have to, I come back to my point, original point, alliance and collective defence is a justification in itself. You don't really need to go much beyond that. It's, of course, important to elaborate the issues, talk about the issues, discuss new threats and new issues, have a document which lays all these things out, because politicians, national politicians, when they're seeking to explain these things to their public, do need these sort of documents to check and to make sure that what they're talking about. But don't expect it to be talked in the pubs and the nightclubs and a sudden surge of activity around Twitter when the new NATO doctrine is released. I promise you it won't happen. On defence reviews, the UK defence review of 1997-98 did make a difference because it provided a rationalisation of things that had happened rather haphazardly, but made decisions. Just as Francois describes the Livre Blanc, made decisions. It had consequences, and these are things that people can talk about. A concept, by and large, doesn't make decisions. It can guide decisions in the future, but it doesn't make decisions. And you'd be very wary about it if all the things about the alliance were going to be decided through this process. It provides a framework for thinking about the decisions you're going to have to make in the future. What I think is important for the alliance is when it really has to justify itself is in a crisis. That is when we know whether it is fit for purpose, is when the crisis comes, which inevitably will be not the crisis that was envisaged in the strategic concept. You can look at, you can mention terrorism, you can go back to mentions of terrorism to the early 1970s, to the Munich Olympics or whatever. There's a lot of discussion about what will terrorism do. But it's never quite the right terrorist threat. It's always a slightly different one to the one you're anticipating, just like we weren't particularly anticipating what happened in Georgia. And our whole view about what's going to happen in Iran has been changed by the events of the last few weeks. All you can do is make sure that this great alliance is fit for purpose, that it's done its best to get its capabilities in order, its decision-making smoother, and it's not so totally surprised by the contours of a new crisis that it flounders around for 2 weeks wondering how it should respond. If you can do that, you've done a good job. Otherwise, you should glorify in the fact that most people think you're uninteresting and boring, because a defensive alliance geared to deterrence is exactly what it should be. Thank you.
A clear message then. Finally, Sven, what would you like to add?
Thank you. On the issue of public support and public diplomacy, I think that it's not an entirely new phenomenon, or the problem is not entirely new, in the sense we've experienced this fundamental weakness of democracies after the two world wars of last century. There is this natural want of people to live in peace and to get the troops home as soon as possible, and that's very good and very welcome, but that makes enforcing peace after war very, very, very difficult, enforcing the terms of peace, and we have to live with that. But we need this critical minimum public support in order to get defense budgets through our parliaments. And that's something we really need. And also, this political solidarity among allies is critically important, I think, to reassure our publics that the alliance is up to its core task, which is the collective defense. And also, the solidarity does not manifest itself only in NATO, but also in other fora such as EU, where the membership is largely overlapping. And on the new threats, or do we need a new concept or a revision of the existing one? I think it's very important that we take the existing one, even though Estonia was not a member when the existing strategic concept was adopted. I think that starting with a blank sheet will definitely create a situation where any omission will actually create a very significant and noticeable void. And something has really changed. I mean, there might have been science fiction movies in 1984, speaking of cyber attacks, but in 1984, there was not a PC around. Today, we have 99% of Estonians filing the tax returns electronically and 90% doing the bank transactions electronically. So the vulnerability is definitely very, very different from what it was in 1984.
Thank you very much indeed to the three of you. And thank you very much indeed for your robustness in accepting the spirit of trying to get as much done in 70 minutes. I'm very struck. We've had 28 interventions in 70 minutes. Work that out as a precedent. Let me leave you now with Constanze Stelzenmüller, who's going to take over for the next session because we want continuity between the sessions.
Hello, everybody. I'm Constanze Stelzenmüller. Nick had asked me to take up a couple of thoughts, which we'll take over into the next session. It seems to me that our first point would be the process won't look like this. At any rate, it shouldn't. As for the question of the deliberations being overtaken by events, I think they already are. We all understand that there are punishing opportunity costs for zero-sum game playing in this kind of process. Finally, while I sympathize with the sentiments expressed by many as to the great unwashed and the role it should or should not play in the deliberations or in the creation of a strategic concept and in their skepticism of youth in particular, it seems to me that we ought to be very careful here. We do need to win the hearts and minds of our very skeptical publics, and we rely on our public's benign indifference at our peril in situations like these. And finally, my last point to you is that possibly the most important function of this process will be producing consensus among ourselves, where at this point there is rather less than we would like to think. Now, we'll be going on to discuss NATO and its relations with the rest of the world in the second session, which was supposed to begin at 11. I think we will have a coffee break. Jamie,
indeed,
can you tell us when we start?
Coffee breaks are fundamental. Costant, thank you. Yes, indeed. We haven't skipped a coffee break because we are running late. I wouldn't be so suicidal, least of all to myself. But before we go to coffee, Nick Gowing, thank you very much indeed for moderating the first session. In your usual robust and dynamic manner, getting us off to such a good start. Thank you, of course, also to Laurie Friedman, Francois Eisberg, Sven Mixer, for giving us the intellectual firepower. Constanze has already teed up her second session, which will begin in exactly 15 minutes from now, so I'd be grateful if you could have a quick coffee. And please, please, ladies and gentlemen, as you exit, you can have the coffee on either floor, this floor or upstairs. Please make use of both floors, please. That will get you served even faster. Thank you very much.